Thank you, Ms. Busy. It's a delight to be here to meet all these wonderful young women and perhaps to interest some of them in considering space flight or engineering or medicine as a career and showing them what fun that we do have. Ms. Pizzi was kind to say that NASA selected me. Actually, it was one of those things that our office received a trip to Australia for 2 weeks, and there was much of a contest for people who wanted to come. I feel very fortunate that I was one of the more senior women in the office and was selected to be able to come here. I feel very fortunate to be able to come and spend a couple of weeks in Australia and meet the people, meet the young people, see what the young women of this country are up to.
Have you done this sort of thing before, talking to students so intensely about your work?
I have never done anything of this length. NASA regards it as one of its charters to educate the public about space and about possibilities of space travel and space exploration. So I frequently talk to young people. I've never really done it on a two-week basis with prepared lectures. Usually I talk about my career, my space flights, or the upcoming NASA mission. So this is a little bit longer, but I think it'll be fun to do.
Are you surprised that a girls' school in Australia has such an interest and intense knowledge about your work and the sorts of things they're doing here? Quite unusual. Does that surprise you?
It is a bit of a surprise, I must admit. But it's exciting that that a woman's school would consider having an astronaut to come and speak and to show their girls that there are some rather unusual things that women are doing these days. So that's nice. I have a medical degree. Back in the late 60s, early 70s, when, I guess late 50s, early 60s, when we were beginning to have a space program, I was in my early teens and thought it would be the most wonderful thing in the world to have an opportunity to fly in space and to see what that was like, but didn't think it was a very realistic goal at the time. There were no women astronauts, but I thought that perhaps someday they would want doctors on a space station. So I proceeded with my medical career, feeling that if I never got into the space program, that medicine was certainly a wonderful thing to do. And as I was finishing my residency in surgery, NASA advertised for the first time that they were taking space shuttle astronauts and they wanted women. And so luckily I had the credentials that they were looking for and was the right age, could pass their physical exam, and so I joined NASA.
So you were one of the first women astronauts?
I was one of the first six, yes.
How did you find working
in such a male world? The way I would describe it initially is it was awkward. At first, I think the men were pretty committed to having more diversity within the astronaut office, but they weren't quite sure how to react to women. We had to go through a fair amount of physical training, and they weren't quite sure whether we could handle all of that or whether how much they should help us with it. They also, I don't think, were quite sure how serious we were about choosing space flight as a career. But that just took a few years to work all of that out, to show them that we were as dedicated to the program as they were, that we could handle the physical demands and perhaps sometimes in a slightly different way, but we were able to do the job, and I think we've been very well accepted now. There are, I believe, 19 women astronauts. One of them is a pilot, the rest are scientists. In an office of about 100 astronauts.
How's seeing the difference?
It is a very unique view from up there, and I think that's the thing that strikes people the most, is that so very few people get to see the Earth from the perspective that we get to see it. And it is indeed beautiful, and we do a lot of preparation to get ready for it. sometimes we're asked, did we feel closer to God there? I heard an interesting comment from Yuri Gagarin, the first man that went into space, and someone asked him after his flight, did he see God in the heavens? And he said, no, he really didn't. And the prelate of the Russian church apparently was asked about that, and he said, doesn't surprise him. If you don't see God on the earth, you don't see him in space. So I think it strengthens one's faith, and because it is a truly remarkable place that we see.
You had a bit of a problem with the first shuttle flight you were on was cancelled. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
You have done some research. It was very difficult, my first flight. About 7 weeks before we were due to launch, a shuttle had a shutdown on the pad, and to make up the schedule, they combined their payload with ours, and we were kind of out of a mission, and we were assigned to a mission about 7 months down the road. So that was difficult, and then we trained for that mission, and that mission also was canceled about a week before it was going to launch, and they told us that we would, because we'd had such a rough time, would get the next up mission, and so we had a month to train for a mission that usually takes a year. So it was kind of a scramble the whole way, but the early days of the shuttle were pretty unpredictable, and most of us realized that and had to cope with it.
Then your second flight was canceled 61 days after the Challenger accident.
Yes.
Then you had more problems with scheduling for SLS-1.
Yes.
Professionally, does it weigh you down a little bit, or how can you keep your enthusiasm with all the changes?
It does. But I think the fact that we realize that it happens to lots of us, it happens to lots of flights, and you know, for the ones of us who have other things going on, for instance, I went from a flight that was supposed to fly in 1986 after Challenger to one that went in 1991, but I had a child in 1989. So I'd like to think that sometimes schedule changes give you the opportunity to do other things. So I feel very fortunate that I've had more time for my family when the flights weren't going well, I've made three flights and feel that that's an excellent career so far.
In association with your cancellation of 51E, you also had a crew change there.
Yes.
How did that affect you? You know, the fact that one person dropped out and another one came on board. And that person was Charles Walker.
Mm-hmm. We actually had, whenever you're named as a crew, you design a crew patch like these. This was the one from that flight. And you have a crew picture made. And we actually, I believe, had four different patches and four different crew pictures made with a shuffling around of crews. It's difficult because you sort of feel like sometimes that you leave friends behind when they're shifted around so they don't fly with you. The other unfortunate thing is at one point in time we had Greg Jarvis on our flight that was rescheduled to fly on Challenger in 86. So it was sort of a tragic sort of thing that hit very close to home. But crews get very close when they train together. We spend an awful lot of time, and you'd rather fly with the people that you started out your training with, but we have to stay flexible and realize that there are other priorities sometimes, and we just kind of have to cope with that.
And how close were you to David Griggs, who flew with you on that mission?
Yes,
and later died?
Very close. Whenever we train as a crew, they're anywhere from 5 to 7 people, and you spend somewhere between 1 and 2 years every day together. Our social lives sometimes are intertwined. We get to know each other's spouses and children and do things together as a group. So yes, I was very close to Dave and his wife and his two daughters. So that's difficult too. I'm frequently asked if I knew the Challenger astronauts, and of course I did. They were all good friends. We're a small enough group of about, back then it was only, I think, 65 or 70 of us in the office, now about 100, but it's a small enough group that we all know each other personally.
When is your next mission? Is NASA told you that?
I've kind of asked NASA for a desk job for the time being after my last flight. My husband is also an astronaut, and he, when I got back from my last flight, was the chief of the astronaut office and was very busy, and now he's picked up another flight assignment to dock with the Mir space station next year. So it's very busy around our house, and NASA's been very good about sort of letting us interleave our flights so that one can stay home and be with the children a bit more while the other one is busy in preparation. So I don't really have one just yet, but probably after the first of the year, they'll probably assign me to something else.
Is it unusual to
find
two astronauts in the
year? We do have three astronaut couples, actually four if you count Bill and Anna Fisher. Anna's on a leave of absence. So it's not terribly unusual. And some of us have met and married through the program. Others have married someone who later was accepted to the program, so it's worked in different ways. But I think when you work as closely as all of us do, that those sorts of things are bound to happen.
Okay, the qualities required for a good astronaut.
The qualities for a good astronaut, to be selected as an astronaut, you have to meet certain educational and experience criteria. The pilots have to have flown at least 1,500 hours of high-performance jet time, and most all of them have been to test pilot school. The scientists have to have advanced degrees or relevant work experience so that they can bring certain skills into our office. Beyond that, you have to pass a fairly rigorous physical exam, psychological exams, tests for claustrophobia. And beyond that, you're interviewed by a selection board, and I think personality probably plays a big role after you've gotten all these people who are very well qualified and physically meet the requirements. Then I think astronauts select people who they feel would fit in with the group. You have to be somewhat outgoing. You have to be a bit of a risk taker because it is a risky business that we're in. And I think that you sort of get a feel when we meet the people whether or not they'll be happy in our office and whether the people will want to work with these people in rather close quarters for a long time. You could probably get into, you know, female psychology in a lot of ways. I think women pretty much offer the same things as men do. Perhaps someday we'll find that women in general are a bit more cooperative and less competitive. But I don't think that that's a big difference when you look at the people that we have in our office. Obviously, the women that we get are on the pretty competitive end of women's psychology. We haven't really found any differences in physiology with women in space either. And I think it's just a question that different people offer different things to our program. It doesn't have a great deal to do with which sex you are. It has to do more with your background, your expertise, that sort of thing.
Can you tell us a bit about your last flight last October?
My last flight was the second Space Lab Life Sciences flight, and it looked at how the human body and animal physiology changes in weightlessness. And we had a number of studies that really completed the experiments that were first started on the Space Lab Life Sciences 1 mission, which was my second mission. In having a mission dedicated entirely to life sciences, we're able to look at anywhere from 4 to 7 subjects and look at all the different systems, the cardiovascular system, the metabolic systems, the vestibular systems, a lot of different things in the same people. There are many medical experiments that are done on astronauts, but usually it's only one or two at a time. And the dedicated life sciences missions gives you a chance to study them all and see how they're all interacting. And also on both those missions, we took laboratory animals, trying to see which animals and in which way animals are good models for what's going on in humans. So that was, I think, a big step forward for us. On my last mission, we were actually able to dissect some animals in space, because some of the changes that occur very rapidly when you return, and so we wanted to see the pure changes as they were occurring in space. Has a great application. NASA selects the experiments that it flies based on such criteria as, does it help us understand how we keep astronauts healthy? Does it answer basic biological principles? But also, how does it help people on the ground? To give you an example, astronauts, when they go into space, begin to lose calcium from their bones very rapidly. It's an accelerated form of osteoporosis. If we can understand in these young, healthy people with no confounding diseases, what changes about the bone that make it begin to lose calcium? Is there a biochemical process? Is there some structural change? I think we'll go a long way to helping older people here on the ground who have very much the same problem. And in all of the experiments we do, you can find a correlate in disease processes on the ground. So hopefully we'll help the general understanding of physiology.
When you were here 11 years ago, you were looking forward to some sort of cooperation with the Russians. Of course, mm-hmm. a decade later, mm-hmm. that is actually happening.
It is.
Is the astronaut office excited about this? Are you looking forward to perhaps a flight in the future, mm-hmm. although you've asked to be grounded in the meantime, mm-hmm. Up to the Mir space station?
I think that would be very exciting. It's one of the exciting things that we're doing now. We're sending astronauts to the Mir space station. We're also having cosmonauts to come and train with us. It will be an interesting mix of programs. It has certain challenges now, as you can imagine. Their programs are different from ours. Sometimes the focus has been different. But combining the two programs is one of the big things that NASA is doing now. Trying to develop not only cooperation with the Russians, but also with other nations, so that we can have something like a space station that's probably one of the very largest things that we have done in the field of international scientific cooperation. And it's taking a lot of work. There are a lot of risks and challenges right now, but I think it's a very exciting thing to do, not only from the scientific aspects and the technical aspects, but from the geopolitical aspects also.
And of course, your life sciences missions have only been 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
They've been going round and round the Earth for years and years. Have you had any feedback from them as to the results of their biomedical experiments?
It's been interesting. There hasn't been a great deal of information from them because they have a different way of doing things. Their emphasis is on going into space and living there. They test people before they leave, and they test people when they get back, and they see what's happened. Our emphasis has been to look at the time course of things. You know, how rapidly do you lose calcium? Does it level off? They've got 2 data points, and frequently they've only got 1 subject on each of their studies because they're limited in the size of the capsules and the station that they have. So we see it as an excellent blend of programs. We have the technology to analyze specimens when they're in space, to bring back large numbers of specimens. The shuttle can return a tremendous amount more samples than a Soyuz capsule can. So we're hoping that it will be a very productive cooperation between the two nations because we have different areas of expertise. Well, I'm glad you asked that. I have a good friend from Melbourne, Vaughn Clift. He's a physician and an engineer that's working with us at NASA. He's very much interested in beginning an effort to get Australia involved in the manned spaceflight program. And I think it would be wonderful if that could happen. As I say, we're beginning international efforts. We're inviting all countries to join us in moving towards an international space station. And I think Australia has so much to offer. The scientific research here could certainly be blended into the sorts of things that we do. I think it would be an excellent opportunity for this nation to get involved in some of the technology that will be developed, certainly to get school children interested in these areas, to have their own Australian Astronaut Corps or Australian experiments or Australian hardware flown in space. I think that would be terrific. But of course, your government has to decide on its priorities of the moment. All we can do is hope perhaps they'll get excited by the things that we're doing.
What do you say to the girl who wants to go to space and still seems like a really unrealistic thing to Australia this whole world?
It is a rather unrealistic goal to have, but it is certainly something that is worth pursuing, whether you ever achieve the final goal or not. Just in getting there, I think there's much to be learned about a lot of different areas. But I look at my own career, and it was totally unrealistic when I started out to think of becoming an astronaut. But somehow I made it, and things change over time, and I think that young women can certainly have an unrealistic goal in mind if it's a good goal, but being realistic, they can pursue other things that would keep them happy and someday perhaps be able to achieve that unrealistic goal. It certainly will improve their chances of achieving other things also.
What's the typical work week of an astronaut in between missions? Not during the immediate training period leading up to a mission, but now, after you come back from a mission, you've done the debriefings, mm-hmm. and before you get assigned another flight, what's a typical week?
Most of us are assigned to what we called technical assignments, in which we help other members of the astronaut corps get ready for their flights, covering some general areas, ascents and entries. I'm working right now on the science that will go on the shuttle Mir flights. So most of us do that. We spend a fair amount of time in the simulators, working out procedures, that sort of thing. We do flying. I fly a T-38. That's why I have a flight suit. We have requirements to keep current in the NASA jets. We do a certain amount of public relations work, although it's generally no more than 2 days a month. There are lots and lots of things that we participate in to help the program and also to learn ourselves. So it's probably about a 50-hour week on the average for most of us, so we stay pretty busy.
And over the years, you must have had quite a variety of technical assignments.
Yes.
What have some of those been?
Early on, I helped develop procedures. We had ejection seats on the first four shuttle missions, and we had helicopters that went and rescued people should they have to jump out of the shuttle, and I helped develop those procedures. I have worked in the software labs that verify all of the computer programs necessary to launch a shuttle. I've helped develop the medical kit that's carried on board. I've worked as a technical assistant to our director of flight crew operations, which is sort of a management trainee spot. Right now, as I mentioned, I'm helping look at the experiments that have been proposed for the shuttle Mir missions. I've served as a CAPCOM, the capsule communicator, who is the astronaut in mission control, who speaks to the astronauts who are in flight. It takes a good bit of practice and simulations to be able to do that. So a great many different things in waiting between my flights.
And a number of astronauts have moved up through NASA administration. Does NASA actually encourage this and train you for this, or do you just simply say, oh, there's a job going here, I'm applying for that?
A little of each. The jobs that we hold within the astronaut office generally increase in responsibility the more experience that you've had. And since Challenger, before Challenger, there was not really a career path into NASA management, and that was flagged as one of the problems that we had within NASA. And since Challenger, there have been more people go from our office into the technical management side of things. So there are spots open. Some people do some preparatory work. Others just simply manage things like managing a crew or managing a branch within our office and later move on into higher management.
So, you've got two sons. Would you like them to follow your husband's footsteps?
I think that would be wonderful if that's what they want to do. It's hard to know whether or not they have any interest in it. I think they, without knowing it, they know a great deal about space and the space program. It gets discussed at the dinner table every day, and they hear a lot of it. My 12-year-old has been to 7 shuttle launches, 3 of mine and 4 of my husband's. So he's seen a lot of them. He's seen the preparation. He's seen the training. But he kind of takes it for granted, much in the way that, young kids do. That's just something your parents do, and I'm not sure that that's what he's really interested in now. I think he at various times talks about being a chemist or being a businessman. So he has all kinds of different dreams of his own. The younger one, it's hard to know right now. He says that he wants to be a pilot and a physician, which keeps both my husband and I happy. So it's too soon to tell, I think. But if that's what they want to do, I think that we think it's a wonderful career would be for them too.
Do you worry much, like many other persons, if their husband's in space or
I'm sorry,
on the ground, or, is there much sort of worrying? It's like,
There is worry because there is a risk. I mean, people say, well, yes, it's risky to go out on the highway or to fly in a commercial plane, but usually you don't watch people take that risk, and that's the difference between flying in space, launching on a space shuttle. Everybody comes and watches you take a major risk in your life. I think parents worry about it, but try not to pass that worry down to their children. And it's only been in the last couple of years that my older boy has realized that this is a pretty risky thing to do and is intellectually able to kind of understand that. The younger one, being somewhat more sensitive, I think is realizing it a little earlier that it is kind of risky, and there's a fair amount of stress when we get ready for flights. But the boys enjoy going to Florida and to Disney World and to the beach and staying in a motel that has a hot tub and a pool and things. So it becomes kind of a family vacation, and that helps take the stress off.
When you first went to space, what was one of the things that surprised you that you didn't expect or that you knew differently?
When the solid rocket boosters ignited, that was a major surprise. That's when you first begin to lift off the pad. We have simulators that actually move and somewhat vibrate, but the boosters igniting causes a great vibration. There's vibration reflected off the pad. There's a lot of noise and a lot of movement, and I thought we'd blown up. But luckily, a couple of seconds later, you realize you're going in the right direction. Everything seems to be under control. Working in weightlessness is another surprise, that no matter how much you watch other people do it, no matter how much my husband had described it to me, it's something that you have to go and do yourself before you realize that it's very different from for instance, floating in water, from moving around here on the ground. And that's one of the things that you learn on your first flight in the first couple of days, and it's something that kind of sticks with you, and that's why people who have flown in space are considered a great resource for people who are designing experiments or designing how to do things in space, because you kind of have to have been there to understand
and
it.
I suppose you can ask this question about respect. Do you believe in UFOs and space?
I believe in the possibility of them. I'm not sure that the ones that we've seen really are UFOs, although very tantalizing. Some of them can't be explained very well. As far as intelligent life, the statistics say that there certainly must be other intelligent life out there. I mean, there are just too many planets and too many stars and to not have some kind of life. But whether it's going to look like ours and have developed in the same way, who knows? But I think it's certainly worth looking for.
There is some room. I've taken various math and science subjects.
I think it's so important for young girls to have someone that they can say, if this person has done this, then I can too. I had to use a sort of melange of role models when I was young. I had a woman physician friend who was an excellent physician, but she'd never married and never had children. So I didn't really want my life to be that way. I had other excellent role models of women who were wonderful parents but had never had careers. So I think it's important that that there are more women doing exciting things now. And girls can see that we're not superhuman. Without my flight suit on, I look like somebody's mother. I could walk into the school and they'd never notice me. And so I'm nothing terribly special. I'm somebody that's worked quite hard and had rather extensive dreams about what I wanted to do. But I think it shows young women that that they can do that. When I was young, the only astronaut role models I had were men, and they hadn't pursued the same kinds of careers, nor did they want the same sorts of things that I wanted necessarily. So I had to sort of take it on faith that someday that would happen. But I think young girls can have a bit more confidence now that they can do those sorts of things too, or they can do things that women have never done before, just because other women have gotten into unusual fields.